19-4005.
Okay.
Donahue versus Wahoughi.
Yes.
Thank
May
you.
May it please the court and counsel, Kara Porter and J.D. Lauritsen for the plaintiff Donahue. I'm going to focus on three issues of fact that we believe exist that render improper the summary judgment granted in this case.
Counsel, could I just ask about a threshold issue? I know you were asked to brief this, and there was this joint submission about finality.
Right.
But I'm still a little up in the air on this. I'm really not sure where Salt Lake City stands at this point, because the motion was brought only, summary judgment motion was brought only on behalf of the officer, and that motion was granted, but there's been no dismissal of the other parties in the district court.
I think there was a perception, understanding, agreement, whatever you call it, among all of the parties that the judge at all times intended that order to dispose of all parties, because the judge ruled that there was no constitutional violation, meaning as a matter of law that the city could not be held liable. And I think it was just a glitch in the judge's wording that was just created by the fact that discovery was bifurcated. But I think, I believe both sides articulated that it is our understanding that the judge fully intended, and perhaps the language wasn't ideal, to dismiss against all defendants.
Two follow-ups. One is, why not just get this clarified in the district court? If the language was imprecise, why not just get a clarifying judgment about where the parties are at this point, number one? And number two, if we agree with you and reverse, or if we affirm on prong two of qualified immunity instead of prong one, then is Salt Lake City back in the picture as far as you're concerned?
Well, except that you can't reverse on the second prong of qualified immunity with respect to the reasonable suspicion, because that has not even been argued. The judge didn't rule.
Well, if we reverse on any ground, is Salt Lake City back in the picture?
If this court ruled, and respectfully, on something that the city is not arguing or the defendants are not arguing, then yeah, the city would potentially be back in. Because,
and so how do we have finality?
Well, because we don't believe that since there is no argument by the defendants with respect to the first dispositive issue, in our view, that the law is not clearly established. Since we're able to string cite cases on that, then we just don't believe that it would be, I understand what you're saying about alternate grounds, but I think that the parties to some extent have some ability to try to frame the issues, and the defendants here have not chosen to say that the law was not clearly established.
I don't want to belabor the point. I just think the record on finality is still a bit muddled.
I would maybe request that we've briefed it and we'd like to argue it. I think the court could do a limited remand just even without having to have us back here again, in that where the court could say, yes, my wording wasn't great, but it was a final judgment, and then we wouldn't lose the benefit of the briefing and of this argument. So we would at least ask for that if we could. And I do want to focus.
Let me. I'm sorry. This is very interesting.
Okay.
To me too. Have you argued in your brief that the city is liable, even if the officer isn't?
Well, that's.
I didn't see anything directed specifically toward the city. It seems like you're just appealing the judgment in favor of the officer.
Well, that's because the trial that. Principle only applies if this court were to affirm on the second prong of qualified immunity, the lack of clearly established law. The trial court didn't rule on that. The defendants have not argued for that. So I would have been having to argue something that is really literally never been brought before this court. And I think that's beyond my burden as an appellant. I mean, I feel like I'm entitled to rely on what the defendants argue and what the trial court says. But and so with respect to the first issue, if I may, just because we believe that any of three issues of fact exist that would compel reversal. And of course we're not abandoning any of the other arguments, where I'm just going to submit them on the brief due to timing issues. First, a jury could have found that there was never any reasonable suspicion of public intoxication. Second, a jury could have found that even if there had been some alleged initial reasonable suspicion of public intoxication by Dr. Donahue, it had dissipated. And any alleged suspicion at the time that he demanded the name in the context of public intoxication was not reasonable and not permitted under the statute. Third, a jury could find that there was no stop, which is required for the stop and identify statute to apply. And I'm just going to briefly address a couple of those. With
was
respect
there ever in the proceedings, not the legal proceedings, but at the proceedings at the scene, was there any suggestion that he was going to be charged with public intoxication? Did that topic come up?
Yes. In fact, as we quoted in our brief, at one point, Officer Wahongi, who was quite irritated with our client, specifically said, "Here's what we're going to do." And he basically then just said, he did not use the word concoct, but that's our characterization. He said, "We'll tell them this. We'll tell them," she said, "you were blitzed out of your mind, and we'll tell them this, we'll tell them that." And of course, he's handcuffed, so a reasonable person could believe that charges potentially were going to be filed, even though there was, by the time that Officer Wahongi requested Dr. Donahue's name in connection with the public intoxication, it was 8.5 minutes into his interaction with Dr. Donahue. And I'm skipping ahead to the point about dissipation, because this court has repeatedly said you cannot ignore new evidence in favor of old stale evidence.
What do you mean dissipation? I mean, she's sobered up in 8.5 minutes?
No, dissipation of reasonable suspicion. I mean, if a neighbor came out and said, "Hey, I just saw that guy kill his wife," and then the wife steps outside and says, "Well, I'm his wife, I'm fine," or whatever, you can't continue on the old information. And there's a lot of case law from this court to that effect. Here, there was a quote from a woman that the officer himself admits he already suspected and who was making suspicious statements like, "I don't know where I live." But she said, "He's drunker than Cooter Brown," which, by the way, if you Google that, it's a very interesting Civil War story. And so Officer Wahongi said, well, he interpreted that to mean extremely intoxicated, blitzed out of his mind. So Officer Wahongi goes over, and for the next 8.5 minutes, he first of all listens to the interaction with Officer Bennett, in which Dr. Donahue says, "I just don't know if I want to press charges. Could I have your business card and I'll make a decision?" And then he himself interacts with Dr. Donahue. And this is where the video is critical. The Supreme Court said in the Scott versus Harris case, when you have a video, you know, the trial court's supposed to interpret the facts consistent with the video.
Or when the video blatantly contradicts. Isn't that the language in Scott?
Exactly.
Okay, but you haven't mentioned that they did ask him if he'd been drinking.
Yes, although, you know when that was? That itself was 5.5 minutes, I mean, you know, into this video before he says anything about the drinking. The first 4 minutes, he is arguing with Dr. Donahue about whether somebody who approaches the police to report something is required to give his name for the report.
Can I just ask you, in terms of the dissipation point, I'd like to zero in on that for a second, because I know one of your arguments is that there wasn't reasonable suspicion to begin with, right?
Ever.
Okay,
right.
But let's assume there was.
Okay.
All right. And then we get to your dissipation point, and what I'd like to know is, in your view, how much time elapsed between forming the reasonable suspicion, which we're assuming for the sake mm-hmm. of discussion, and asking for his name?
Oh, well, I don't think he ever had reasonable suspicion, but here...
I know you don't, but that isn't the question. The question is, assuming reasonable suspicion of the public intoxication offense to the point where he asks for his name, the officer asks for his name, how much
if
time
elapsed?
If
he formed reasonable suspicion, you mean, I guess it would depend when he formed it. I can answer this. I'm sorry.
Let me just explain. Isn't that the relevant period for dissipation? Because once he asks for his, if he has reasonable suspicion, asks for his name, and he won't give his name, then we've kicked over to the name disclosure statute, right. Not the public intoxication.
Right, and we've tried to give a chronology of that. There was
I'm just
4 minutes.
Okay, 4 minutes. Is that the answer?
Yes, he did not ask for Dr. Donahue's name until 10 seconds before he handcuffed him.
Right.
And all of that's on the video. Also, this is important, too, and I really am going to want to reserve some time, so I'm just going to skip ahead briefly to this issue about the stop and whether there was a detention, because that does matter quite a lot. There, the first time that Officer Wahongi asks for the name is 8.5 minutes into the interaction, into his observations of Dr. Wahongi, but it's our contention that there was no detention or stop. Therefore, it was still consensual. A jury could have found that. The defendants themselves acknowledged that this was certainly an initially a voluntary encounter initiated, in fact, by the citizen. And so in order then to demand that he give a name and to arrest him for not doing it, then the officer Wahongi had to show that it became a stop under the statute. Well, here we have nothing. You know what Officer Wahongi said when he first got there? He said, if you don't give us a name, we're not going to help you. We're going to walk away. Okay, that doesn't mean there's a detention. Dr. Donahue, at no point is there a statement that you're detained or not free to leave. And then Dr. Donahue stays because he has asked him, he's mad now at Wahongi, and he says, please get your sergeant here. So he's waiting for the sergeant, and at no time is there actually any kind of a statement, you're detained, you're not free to leave, or whatever. I mean, Bennett didn't think he was intoxicated, and
he was handcuffed at that point. Correct?
No. He's waiting for the sergeant. He's asked for the sergeant twice.
He wasn't handcuffed?
He was not handcuffed at that point. I mean, it's hard to go through with the chronology, but we did attach a rough transcript and the video, which is so critical in this case.
But when was he handcuffed? I thought he was handcuffed before the sergeant got there.
Well, he was handcuffed before the sergeant got there, but he had asked twice for the sergeant, had no way of knowing that he supposedly was not free
to
leave.
I understand.
Yeah. And if I may, I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Reserve. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is John Delaney. I represent the appellees in this matter.
Including the city?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good question.
I want to jump to one point quickly. We agree. The video is very important. The timing of this is very important. The timing is captured in the video. And you will see that as early as 2 minutes and 30 seconds into the interaction between Mr. Donahue and Officer Wahongi, the issue of Mr. Donahue not providing his name and then being told immediately within 10, 15, 20 seconds about the allegations alleged by Amy about him being intoxicated, and about him causing the confrontation that began the interaction at the very beginning to begin with. So, Judge Matheson, your question about how long does it take, if you review the video, you'll see that that happened beginning at about 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Well, but was there... I understand he declined to give his name then. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
But was at that point reasonable suspicion for public intoxication at that 2 minute, 2+ minute point?
Yes, that existed because prior to Officer Wahongi going over, let me set it up. Officer Bennett is talking with Mr. Donahue. Officer Wahongi comes over and stands off to the side because he has just been speaking with Amy. So he got Amy's side of the story. Officer Bennett is getting Mr. Donahue's side of the story. Officer Wahongi walks over armed with the information that Amy has given him about being drunker than Cooter Brown and about starting the confrontation. Because they both had approached the officers.
And when the first, just one more. When he wouldn't give his name the first time he was asked, was that enough for probable cause under the statute on failure to identify?
Yeah, I believe that reasonable articulable suspicion existed at that point based on the allegations that Wahongi had knowledge of. He had enough suspicion to think this guy could be publicly intoxicated.
Well, no, that wasn't what I was asking. Oh. I was saying once he declined, the first time he declined to give his name, did that create either reasonable suspicion or probable cause for a violation of the failure to identify?
I think that created probable cause.
That first time?
Yeah, the first time, yes. Yeah. It wasn't acted on.
I'm just trying to get the big picture here.
Sure, you're
right. Like, what's the message here? I mean, no good deed shall go unpunished? Is that kind of the thought here? I'm sitting in my house having a cocktail, which would be unusual because I don't, but let's say I was. And I see somebody over at my neighbor's yard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there may be something untoward going on.
Okay.
So I just go over there to find out what it is.
Okay.
Next thing I know, I got police all over me. They're demanding to know who I am. I mean, holy cats. Is that the picture here, or what's the big picture?
I don't think it's that innocent, and I don't think it's that clean. I think we have a person walking home.
I thought that's what he said.
Well, that's not what the evidence in the record shows. It shows that he was walking home at 10:45 at night. It's dark. And he sees a person, for purposes of summary judgment, on this other person's porch. He confronts this person.
Says, what are you doing here? I know my neighbor and my neighbor's friend.
You could read it a little vigilantism or not.
Right.
But he, according to Amy, threatens her and scares her. He calls her a choice word. It's in the briefing. And she feels threatened by this. And she says he's drunker than Cooter Brown. So Officer Wahongi has this information from now one person. Now he's got to get information from the other person. In the meantime, Amy's cooperating. She's given her name, which is alleged to have been fake. She gave an address, which she didn't know her new address, but she knew her old address. She's cooperating. They go over to talk to Officer Wahongi, goes to talk to Dr. Donahue, and he's not willing to cooperate about anything. And so they have to make a credibility determination about who they're going to believe in the investigation. Now, none of that's part of the record. That's part of the big picture sort of thing.
Yeah,
and that's what these guys are dealing with. And they're trying to figure this out. Wahongi is then talking with Mr. Donahue, and Officer Bennett goes and talks with Amy, because he has yet to speak with Amy. He comes back and reports to Mr. Donahue in Wahongi's presence a consistent story, for the most part, about what Wahongi had previously heard in the face of somebody who won't provide their name. Now, it is true, they were arguing about him needing to provide his name to so the police could fill out their reports, an administrative function. But he had already told Mr. Donahue about the allegations and that he was a potential suspect in what was initially brought to the police officers about 5 minutes before. Wahongi, or Officer Bennett, comes back.
Wait, a suspect for what? What would he be a suspect for?
For being publicly intoxicated. And so that is all out there on the table. Officer Bennett comes over. Once again, he reports to Mr. Donahue what Amy has just told him, and Officer Wahongi's right there. Once again, Officer Wahongi says, sir, we need your name. And he says, no. And that's when the arrest sequence began. And that is at about 8 minutes and 31 seconds. Probable cause for that arrest arose well before that point. It was based on the reasonable, articulable suspicion.
So it is a case of no good deed shall go unpunished.
I don't know if this was a good deed, Your Honor. I'm not sure. Yours sounds like a great deed. I don't know if this was a good deed.
What was he doing on the porch?
What
is his view of what he was doing on the porch?
I think he was trying to be. I think his view would be that he was trying to be a good neighbor. You'll see on the video that he has some problems. He's had some problems with the police in the past, not trusting them, putting his name out there, and not liking the results. That's unclear.
Well, but when he walked down the street, I guess the police were on a call to the house a few doors down.
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
And so he decides to go down the street along with Amy. And you say he wasn't cooperating, but didn't he cooperate to a certain degree? I mean, he was telling the officers why he came to talk to them. He talked to them about the porch incident.
Yeah.
He also didn't want to get involved. He said that a bunch of times, but I'm not sure, is it fair to say that he wasn't cooperating at all?
No. And I don't mean to misstate that. No, he did do what you said. In comparison to Amy, he was less cooperative of the two. And that's in our briefing.
What about the on the public intoxication, reasonable suspicion? Why was there, why did he pose any sort of danger?
I'm sorry?
Why did he pose any kind of danger to himself or others?
Well, I think, again, we're dealing with reasonable, articulable suspicion, not probable cause. So he didn't have to prove that he was endangering anybody.
Well, but what was the reasonable suspicion for that?
That he had threatened Amy and she was scared. And those are the facts that he had as part of his reasonable suspicion on, I guess, that element.
I guess burglars sometimes get scared.
Well, I don't think that she was established as a burglar.
What was she doing there?
I don't know. We don't know.
Well, what's Utah case law say about what it requires for there to be a danger? Is there something about if you're having an argument in the street or something like that?
No, there is one case, and it's addressed in the brief, called Due South. And it's a Utah Supreme Court case that deals with it in the regulatory enforcement context. But it's a curious opinion because at one level, it seems to suggest that you have to have at least reasonable, articulable suspicion to...
of a danger.
Yeah, that somebody is in danger. But the cases they rely on are these Texas cases that have similar statutes. And they come up in the conviction setting. So it's beyond probable cause in those. It's actually a conviction. So it's kind of odd what Utah law says. But when you look at what the opinion says, they're talking about this, you've got to have something more than a speculative possibility. And a speculative possibility is not reasonably articulable suspicion. That's the hunches. Those are the things that are less than reasonable articulable suspicion that are not protected. What they articulated is something closer to reasonable articulable suspicion, but yet they rely in support on these cases that go much further than that. So does that answer your question about what Utah law provides?
Well, I thought Due South gave us an example, arguing in the middle of the street.
I'm sorry?
An example given by Due South, I thought, was arguing in the middle of the street, but you say it didn't say that.
No, there is a case from in Utah that addresses the intoxication statute, and there was a guy who clenched his fists. I think that might be what they're talking about. In the face of an officer in an alleyway in Ogden, Utah, if I remember the facts right.
Okay. So you haven't argued in the alternative on this particular issue for an affirm on the basis of failure to show clearly established law?
Well, I think that's a question of law that this court always has the opportunity.
Have you made that argument, though, in your brief?
I Maybe I didn't make it in this brief. I sure made it below. But counsel is correct. Judge Kimball did not rule on that element or that prong of the analysis.
Yeah. Let's say we did reverse on that. Is the city still in the picture in this case?
If you sent the whole case back?
Well,
yeah, I would think that the city would be, we'd be back to where we were before Judge Kimball issued his decision, because we would have, in essence, lost. One other thing I wanted to raise is this issue about the stop. This notion of what the statute...
Oh, you know, I may have misspoke. If we affirmed on that ground, let me restate the question. If we affirmed on prong two instead of prong one, what happens to the city then? Because then there'd be no underlying constitutional violation. There would only be lack of clearly established law.
Yeah. Well, Judge Kimball already... You'd have to reverse him on that first one because he said there was no constitutional.
Well, maybe we just affirm on the alternative ground. What would happen to the city then?
I think the case would
still be gone.
Would still be gone
because you still got the initial ruling.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But may I speak to the stop element? That's an interesting argument. The statute at issue 77.715 is the codification of the Terry Doctrine under Utah law. In fact, this court in Oliver v. Woods characterizes that statute as such. And what we know about the Terry Doctrine and about these stops is that there's three levels of encounters. There's consensual, there's investigative, and then there's arrest. And so what we have here is, And we've conceded this, is that, sure, when Mr. Donahue and Amy approached the officers and said, hey, we have a problem, that was consensual. But as soon as an investigation was begun based on reasonable, articulable suspicion of Amy advising Officer Wahongi that this is what happened, It was moving towards, if not became, at least an investigative detention.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your argument. So did you have...
I'm just going to correct a few factual boo-boos that I think we just heard from counsel. First of all, I'm correct on the 4 minutes, because if you add 2 minutes and 30 seconds of Wahongi talking to Dr. Donahue plus the minute 30 that he observed him talking to Bennett, that's 4 minutes. In the defendant's brief on page 21, they actually state the point at which they believe the encounter was moving away from consensual. Notice that they don't even try to say it was even a stop even then. But that's when Amy was first mentioned. And that is, I believe, we've got it in our brief, but that's around the 4 minute or so at that time. But the first time, and so according to them, that's when it was at least in their minds potentially non-consensual. The first time there was a name requested after that was not until 8:26 on Wahongi 2, which is 10 minutes of observation and interaction. That's the first time. And when Dr. Donahue said no, then within 10 seconds, he was arrested. We were told that the first time he declined his name would be probable cause to arrest, and yet everyone agrees that the first times he was declining his names, it was for purposes of pressing charges. A big one, there is absolutely zip, nothing in the record where Amy said he threatened her. No. She said, he called me a piece of S. Okay, there was nothing on that. Dr. Donahue reported that she had actually struck him. And in fact, instead of retaliating, he went over to get the police. Two more factual things, if I may. There was a statement that by the time that when they were arguing about whether he has to press charges, we were told just now that that was after he'd already talked about Amy's allegations. Not correct. From the video and the chronology, they spent the first several minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, arguing about whether you have to give a name. That I'm certain that your clerks will be able to nail that down. And then one last thing.
Thank you for gratuitously telling us how to use our clerks.
I did not mean that in an insulting way. I did not. I apologize if it was construed that way.
You don't need to apologize, but it's not a good practice.
No, I apologize. There was a comment about problems with the police in the past, and he was talking about one other time that he had reported something. I think they were trying to imply that he has some sort of criminal record.
Let me ask one question. One of your arguments is there was no stop, so the statute requiring you to report your name was not satisfied. Mm-hmm. I just looked through the argument of your opening brief, and I couldn't find that argument made that there was no stop. Can you tell me where it is in that brief where I missed it?
Yeah, I'm sure we can find that because we did.
Just send it to us. You don't need to take it.
I'll send that, yes. Okay. We argued it was consensual and non-consensual and all that. We'll cite that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for presenting your case so patiently with us. The counsel are excused. The case is submitted. Court is in recess until tomorrow morning. The clerk will announce the recess.